Yeah. Bill says to me, "You want to go to work?" And I said, "Sure." He says, "Go downstairs." He says, "Help them men." He says, "That are taking all that food out of there." And there was all kinds of food, cheese, and I remember so much. At that time, the NC company sold groceries.
Mm-hmm.
Besides their clothing, you know, and they had a grocery spot there, and liquor, too. So anyway, that started me off, and he kept me working there. And I stayed there for several months. And then one day I decided, well, and he paid me 80 cents, they paid me 80 cents an hour. And they worked me.
Long days?
Not too long, 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
8 hours a day, which was okay. Yeah. But, you know, I was always intent on going out to a mining camp. So I lined myself up, and there was a fellow that was, I used to go into the Nordale Hotel because at that time all these miners used to go and live there until they got taken out to the creeks. But I had gotten a room it was a finished bathhouse on First Avenue.
Oh, I think I've heard of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on First Avenue. It was a finished bathhouse there. Yeah, I was just trying to think of their name. But anyway, I got a room there for $12 a month. Yeah, and the lady that run it, she says, you can take a finished bath, I'll give you the towels, anytime you want, which was very nice of her. And that's where I lived. So I got lined up with a fellow that had a contract to drill up on Caribou Creek, up on the Salcha River.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed a man that could fire a boiler and keep the drill working. And so I took that job. And I went out there, and they flew me there. The first time I'd ever been on a plane.
Mm. Do you remember who flew you, one of the bush pilots?
Yeah, his name was Herm Joslin, the pilot that took me there. And it was the... what was the name of that outfit now? Pollock Airways.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Pollock Airways. So, anyway, the pilot... See, at that time I smoked. And I rolled my own cigarettes with Bull Durham. And so I had taken a whole box of Bull Durham and a box of matches with me on the plane, and my gunny sack, and my sleeping blankets and so forth. All they supplied out there was a little bed, mm-hmm. and you had to bring your own sleeping bag. So anyway, we got down. He flew above the camp, and he showed me where the drill was, and he showed me where he was gonna where they would pick me up with one of those Gold Devils. You'd use that to carry freight on it to the camp, just maybe a mile.
A track vehicle?
It was like a sled vehicle, see, mm-hmm. but they had a cat there, one of the big caterpillar deals, and with a big blade on it. So, but they used that to come in and hitch up with that Gold Devil sled-like and pulled it in. See, and I went with him.
Mm-hmm.
But what took place there was that when he was loading up the plane in Fairbanks here at the Weeks Field, they could smell a little smoke coming out of the plane. So, you know, and me, I didn't know what was going on. So Herm says, "We have to take all the baggage out, quick." So took all the baggage out. Sure enough, what happened was, that box of matches that I had taken along with me, you know, somehow got set up, and it was from my bag there. the smoke was coming from. But anyway, there was no fire really, you know. But anyway, we put everything back in the plane. And then when he flew over the camp, and then he says to me, Frank, he says, there's bears around this camp. He says, so you have to be careful. But he says, they know that you're going to be here. And I had some freight to come in here. And he says, they'll be picking you up. So you stay there. We're right there by the field. So I said, okay. So then he turned the plane around and he started to take off. But he didn't have enough wind, like, you know, to lift the wings. And he ended up at the edge of that field where it was all dug up a little bit, you know, and he couldn't go no farther. And so the plane kind of tipped down and the propeller hit the gravel, you know. And anyway, then I ran towards him. But in the meantime, I had been warned, you know, to take a net with me, see. And I put it over my head, see, and I had one of those hats, you know.
Mosquito
net, because boy, I tell you,
yeah, there were
millions of them mosquitoes. And so what happened was that I had that net down there and down on my face. So then I went to him and I thought, well, I said to him, I says, what can I do to help you, you know? Well, he says, Frank, he says, here's what we'll do. He says, first, he says, we picked up the tail end of the plane, and we headed it towards back on the field again, see? Mm-hmm. And so then he says to me, you stay, he showed me where to keep my hands on that wing and to push whenever he gunned the engine, see, the propeller. Mm-hmm. He had to straighten out the propeller.
Because it didn't get unscathed in that kind of
way. Yeah, because the thing, when he hit the gravel, you know, threw the plate up. Well, then he straightened that out. But anyway, I followed his orders, and I pushed whenever he gunned that engine, and finally got it back onto the field itself. See? Mm-hmm. So then he went back, and then he turned around and made another run for it, see? That time he was successful in lifting that plane up. And then he went on his way for dropping off some more freight someplace else. But I waited there anyway. And so that's how I got to working there in that spot there. We were, his name was Mike Ersig. He was the contractor on those claims. For a company that was interested in those claims, from San Francisco. And so there was a lot of claims that were open. Mm-hmm. So this fella, Mike Ersig, what he was doing was every time, about every 50 feet, we would drop down a hole on the creek, see? Mm-hmm. And he knew by the maps that he had that the adjoining claim, nobody owned it. So what he did was he put his claim on it, see, on that particular claim.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And anyway, eventually the company found out about it, what he was doing. So they shut down the operation. So I had to go back into town again.
That put you out of a job.
Put me out of a job. But I was making 71 cents an hour there. Mm-hmm. And I was working 10 hours a day. I was getting $7.10 a day. And they fed me. And But, you know, that was very interesting because I worked hard. I split the wood to get it into that boiler, mm-hmm. and also make sure that there was enough steam to operate the drill rig, you know. Mm-hmm. So the driller, he wouldn't have to wait until it's get a good head of steam. But eventually, we had to leave there, and they took us into town again. And
so the job lasted just that one summer?
No, it lasted maybe a couple of months or so, you know. But then I was out of a job, and I went back to find out if I could get another room in the same place. And sure enough, she had a bed for me there. So I went back into the... her name was Mrs. Simponen, S-I-M-P-A-N-E-N. And she had two sons, two boys and one girl, I remember, you know.
Yeah, I think I've heard that name.
I was trying to think of the name of the finished bathhouse. I'll think of it.
It will come. Wasn't it on First Avenue?
Yes.
I think I remember that where it was.
Eventually there was a next to it. There was that fellow that was selling those GM cars, General Motors, he had, and trucks. Yeah. So I stayed there, and the following year, I spent the winter there. And
spent the winter in prison.
Yeah. And then in the spring of 39, we had, during the carnival days, you know, I used to go into the Nordale Hotel quite often, and I got acquainted with one of the clerks there. Roy Blockus, his name was. He was in charge at that time of the clerks, you know. So one day I walked in there like I said, they always had, they had to shovel the snow from the roof, because in those days they got a lot of snow here, and so Roy says to me, "Say," he says, "would you like to help Adolf Stock, who was the maintenance man there at the hotel?" He says, "He needs help to shovel the snow off the roof." And I said, "Sure, I'll be going up there." So anyway, that's how I started to work at the Nordale Hotel,
by shoveling
the snow from the roof. And they kept me after all the snow was shoveled. They kept me as his helper. Adolf Stock's helper. And then, in those days, the train came in on a Thursday and left on a Saturday. And every time the train came in, they would have me help them take the tourists or whoever was on the train, come into the hotel to carry the baggage up, bell hopping, in other words, you know. And in those days, we didn't have no elevator. And that was a three-story hotel. And I'll tell you, those suitcases that those guys carried, they were so heavy, I thought they'd have rocks in those suitcases. That's a fact. Boy, I tell you, I'm glad I was young and able to do that. That's right. So anyway, that's the way it worked out. And I stayed there until the war broke out in 40. In 42, I enlisted out here at the field because I figured they were going to draft me. And I heard a lot of stories of the people that were being drafted here in Fairbanks. They sent them down to Anchorage for boot training down there. And after boot training, they were sending them out to the Aleutian Chain. And at that time, the Japs were on Kiska and Attu Islands. I heard so much about the bad weather that they had down there, the winds and the heavy rains, and you can hardly see the sun from all the information I could gather. So, you know, at that time, they were still building the field out here, and there was not enough housing for the officers that were coming up here. So we took some of the officers until their housing was finished out here in Ladd Field.
Mm-hmm. So they stayed at the hotel.
Yeah, they stayed at the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So one evening, I was working from 5 to midnight. One evening, one of those fellows, he happened to be a lieutenant at that time. He came into town just to get away from the field, you know, and see what's going on in town. And he stopped in at the hotel. Well, we greeted each other. He knew me, I knew him. So I talked to him there, and I said to him, Lieutenant, I said, what would be my chances of me staying here if I went out there and I enlisted? He says, Frank, he says, I work in personnel. And he says, if you come out there and see me, he says, I'll see that you are stay here in Fairbanks at Ladd Field.
You asked the right person.
Yeah, and I said, gee whiz. I says, I'll come out and see you. But I had to give my boss some notice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't just leave him without a clerk, you know. So I gave him the notice. And then on December the 4th, I went out there and I enlisted.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me, they gave me 3 days to clear up my business in town and to report back on December the 7th, which I did. And boy, that was a cold winter.
That was 1942.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, anyway, what they were doing was, I had to go to headquarters and report in there. And then they had a truck there that took, I think there was 3 or 4 of us from that headquarters building. They were going to send me, they were going to take me into the camp where the barracks were.
Mm-hmm.
And so where I could stay there and get my boot training there, see, which I did. Well, you know, when you go into the service, you know, you take as little as possible with you because they're going to give you clothing, you know, uniform and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just took a little jacket, although it was cold, you know. I figured, well, I'll make it somehow. So I jumped into this truck. It was one of those type, you know, that they cover with canvas, you know, on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I sat in there's two benches on each side of the where you sit down there.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat there, and as the truck was going on the road going towards the camp, and we were parallel with the airstrip there, see.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this plane going down the airstrip, and the pilot was really gunning it, you know, and made a lot of noise, you know. And with that extreme cold weather, you know, the noise was getting much louder.
Yeah.
So I kind of looked a little bit, you know, on the side, and here I see this plane going, and I could see flames from the back side of that. And in those days, it was a propeller plane, see.
Mm-hmm.
And they had B-25s and B-26s out here. And also, what they were doing was they were training some of the Russian pilots they had brought in from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were training them to fly these planes to Siberia from Fairbanks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were ferrying them over there, see. And from there, there was another group that would ferry that plane or our planes
mm-hmm.
to another spot until they got them to the front lines in Russia. But I didn't know what was going on, you know. But then I heard what took place. So as the plane was going up, all of a sudden, the plane went on the side. And it dove into the ground. And it killed the American instructor, pilot, the officer there. And it killed, I understand it was a major that was behind the controls there.
Mm-hmm.
And killed him too, see.
Mm-hmm.
And the plane caught fire. And so what happened was, as we were approaching that spot there, the driver, he slammed his brakes because he could see better than we could, you know, because we were in the back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that we could see through was that little spot there, you know, where they had there, where the canvas, you know, overlaps the forward part of the
mm-hmm.
where the driver is sitting. And he made a big stop, you know, and I looked out, and when he stopped, sure enough, you know, I could see this flames. So I grabbed down to the, I had no gloves, I grabbed down to the tailgate. And boy, I tell you, that really felt cold. And I jumped out. And then I looked towards where the plane was, you know, that had crashed. And I thought, gee, I don't know if there was any ammunition on that plane or not. I didn't know what was going on. So I ran back. I followed the tracks of where the truck had made, see, mm-hmm. when he was trying to back out.
Is that how far were you from the plane?
I was maybe about a couple of hundred feet away. But anyway, then what happened was they finally got to the point where the truck was able to go by on the road there where he was, mm-hmm. and he took us into the camp, and we were there for 30 days. But you know, every day that what they trained us in, you know, why you had to, before they released you to go from training into the camp itself, into the wherever they were going to assign you, mm-hmm. why you had to go on the firing range. So it was so cold that they couldn't allow us to go on the firing range, because of the ice fog, and we couldn't see the targets anyway. But one day, the temperature rose to 38 below zero, and the sun was breaking in. So they said, we're going out. So there we were, and they took us out to the range. That day, I had to do the firing, and the next day, I had to pull the targets, you see, so the other guys could fire. So I got over there, and I could just barely see that target, but I made it, you know. But my fingers froze, because I didn't have the right equipment, you see. All they gave me was a pair of shoes and a pair of overshoes. Well, you know, being out there, those overshoes, they freeze, you know, very hard. And of course, being in the shoes, and the shoes that they gave me were a size not wide enough, size D, I guess. Well, the size was okay, but the width was kind of tight on me. And so my toes were like that, because what happened was I put two pair of socks on, knowing that I was going to be out there all day, see, mm-hmm. or until it got dark. So I couldn't move my toes, see, they were not free. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened, see, they got real cold, mm-hmm. almost freezing, to the point, you know, where I could feel them, and gee, they really hurt. And finally I got through firing, and they took us back into camp before it got dark. And then what took place there was, boy, I thought I'd just barely taken my shoes off. It hurt. Mm-hmm. So I thought to myself, what am I going to do? Tomorrow they're going to get me out there again. So I went to the kitchen that they had there, and I asked one of the boys if he had any gunny sacks there. Sure, he says, help yourself. He says, they're right there. You know, the potatoes come in, you know, gunny sacks. So what I did then was the next day, I put two pair of socks on also, but no shoes. Mm-hmm. And then I wrapped my feet with the gunny sacks. Mm-hmm. And then I put the whole foot into the overshoes.
Mm-hmm. So you had more room.
Yeah, but I could feel my toes. They were loose, you know. Mm-hmm. I was okay. And then I went out on the firing range. And there I had to pull targets for the guys that were shooting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
what's involved in pulling targets? When you say pull targets, what do you
pull do? Pull targets. I had to pull the target up. And
on
then
a frame?
It was on a frame. The target was on a frame, see. Mm-hmm. And it was probably about 100 yards away from where they were shooting, see.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I would do is every time they changed positions, see, they stopped firing. Well, when they stopped firing, we knew that they were going to change from, say, a prone position to a standing position, see?
Mm-hmm.
So that gave them a little time to replenish their ammunition, you know, or in that kneeling position, too, see?
Mm-hmm.
And so at that time, we pulled the target down, and wherever the holes were, see, why, we would paste them. see, because if they wanted to know how many shots were being fired from each position, see. Well, that's what we did. And then after we pasted the holes, we'll pull the targets up again. And soon, pretty soon, they would start firing again.
See? Oh, I see. Use the same
same target.
But just
same
and
we pasted the holes, see. They wouldn't.
And then where would you be while you were firing? You'd run back behind them?
Well, then when, no, what took place then, see, was after all the firing was done, then they all got us together and took us back into camp again, see, and the firing was all over with, and we were free, that is, they were going to, whatever we wherever they assigned us to do, but what took place there was that, in my case, because I had been working in a hotel, see, that officer, I think he kind of helped me out a little bit there, because they assigned me on special duty, and I, my job was to do the same type of work that I was doing at the hotel, because they had pilots coming up from Great Falls, Montana, ferrying these planes, these attack planes, A-20s, B-25s, whatever, come up through Canada, go through Whitehorse, and then into Ladd Field. And there, of course, they had to have a place to sleep. So my job was to see that they got a bed in one of the buildings that they had assigned for these officers. And they used mostly non-commissioned officers' quarters for these pilots that brought them in. And they were all first lieutenants or second lieutenants, you know, that flew these planes in there. And so I used to, my job was to see that they got a bed. And then if the weather was clear the next day, they would ferry all these pilots back into Great Falls, Montana, see? And they left the planes there. And if the weather was good or clear, they would, these planes were given to the Russian pilots, and they would fly them across Galena, across into Moses Point, across into Siberia, just barely into Siberia. And then they took one of the DC-3 planes and they ferried those boys back into Fairbanks again, into Ladd Field,
those Russian pilots. If they would just do a certain leg of the trip and then they would, oh, I see.
See, they only took them just so far and then they brought them back. So they could take another plane across if it was available, or if the weather was good enough, because lots of times they couldn't fly because of the ice fog. It came down low, you know, when it was very cold. So
you spent the duration of the war in.
I was there. I was there for 28 months. But what? Then what took place there was that. See, those Russian pilots, they didn't have a club, so they used the American officers' club, see, and they loved to play the slot machines. In those days, they allowed them slot machines there, see.
Now, where would this be, on base?
Yeah, on base, yeah. See, because those Russians, they would eat in the same mess hall as the American officers ate, you know. And so, then they had nothing else to do, see. Because they didn't have a club. But what took place was the Americans decided that they would give them their own little clubhouse, see, where they had pool tables in there, ping pong tables there, and many, many tables with where they could play chess. They loved to play chess, you know, those Russians did, see. And so one day I says to the man, the captain who was in charge, I said, "Captain," I said, "do you have a man to go there, you know, at the club?" And he said, "No, Frank." He says, "I don't." And I said, he says to me, "Would you like to go there?" And I said, "Yeah, if it's possible." He says, "Can you speak Russian?" "No," I said, "but I think I can learn to get along with these guys." I said, "I see them, you know, quite often." And so, he says, "Well," he says, "we're going to open up in about 3 days," he says, "and you can go there." So So after they opened up, I went there. I bought a dictionary from Dave Adler, who was...
The book.
You remember he had a little spot there across the way from it, mm-hmm. in his post office? Yeah. So Dave had these little Russian
English
dictionaries, you know, little pocket dictionaries. So I bought one from him. It cost me $1. But anyway, I took that with me, and I figured, well, in the beginning, I'm going to be using this quite a bit. So the way it worked out was I went there, and I got along. I got along with those guys. I was the bartender, and they wanted to get some machines, slot machines. So I said, they told me, they said, you're going to town quite a bit, Frank. They said, why don't you try to see if you can locate some slot machines for us. So I went into town, and at that time, I don't know, there was a fella here that used to take the tourists from Fairbanks and down to Valdez, and he would stop at these
roadhouses.
Those roadhouses.
Mm-hmm. Bobby Sheldon?
No, it wasn't Bobby Sheldon. No, Bobby Sheldon. He was the postmaster. See,
mm-hmm.
at that time. Well, anyway, they would stop there, and he would give them. He put the slot machines in those roadhouses.
Mm-hmm.
This fella, I can't think of his name offhand. But anyway, one day I contacted him, and I asked him if he had any slot machines that he would want to sell. Oh, sure, he says. Frankie says, I have three of them, he says. I got them in boxes. And he said to me, and I said, well, how much are you going to ask for them? He says, if you give me $100, he says, I'll give you the three machines. Geez, I went back to the post and talked to the captain, and I told him, I says, I can get three of those machines. I says, a quarter machine, a dime machine, and a nickel machine for $100. And he said, go to the office, and he says, have, let's see, what was his name? He worked in the office. Ringstad. His name was Ringstad. Yeah, they're from the Ringstad family.
Oh, my God.
And he was working in the same, he was on special duty, too.
Was it Mark Ringstad, or, one of the brothers?
Yeah. It wasn't Mark. It was one of the other brothers. I forget his first name. Very nice guy. He says, you tell him to write you out a check for $100. And he says, you give it to that man. And so that's what I did. I got the three machines, and then we took them to the Russian Officers Club, see? Mm-hmm. And boy, I tell you, those guys, they went crazy. They played those machines constantly, you know? And the money that was drawn from there was taken in to operate the clubs, you see.
Right, so it went back into the office.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And my job was to see that I had enough cigarettes, I had enough beer, and enough candy bars, and enough change to supply the boys when they came. When I got through working, you know,
mm-hmm.
I would open up about possibly around 5 o'clock. And then I would close the club about maybe 11 o'clock at night, see? And so I'd lock her up. And then I would take all the cash and I had cigar boxes there, you know, kind of like that. I took it over to the main office in the officers' club.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I'd leave it there, and then I would tell them what I needed, see? And so sometimes I'd have to go to the quartermaster and get candies and whatever, yeah, and order the beer. The beer in those days came in mostly Olympia beer mm-hmm. that we got, and they came in cases packed in sawdust.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the bottles were packed in sawdust.
Sure. Small bottles.
Yeah, it was those little stubby bottles, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I sold the beer there for 10 cents a bottle on the bar, see.
Mm-hmm.
and the cushion and the candy bars I sold for a nickel, and the cigarettes I sold for a nickel also, 5 cents a pack. But my orders were not to give them more than 2 packages of cigarettes a day,
mm-hmm.
and two candy bars a day. They rationed me out, you know,
mm-hmm.
because, and then, anyway, that was okay. So, I got to learn a lot, not a lot of Russian, but quite a bit. And I tried to converse with those boys. A lot of them were young, like me, you know.
Mm.
Young pilots, they were good guys, you know. I enjoyed
Did any of them speak English at all? Or were they?
Well, some of them spoke a little English, you know, very little. But I was always out with that dictionary, you know. And boy, they enjoyed that, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure they appreciated it.
I would point to that. Yeah, see?
Yeah.
And in English, then, I showed them the English part. Right next to it was the Russian part, see? Oh, yeah, that worked fine. But anyway, that lasted for a little while. And then, I remember one of those pilots, those Russian pilots, it was in the morning, I believe, when this took place. He took off normally, and then he found out that he was running out of oil or something. And he circled the field, and he got a hold of the tower on the radio, see?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was his excitement. I don't know if he spoke broken Russian and English both or whatever it was. But they didn't understand them to begin with, see?
Mm-hmm.
And so he circled the field again, see? And of course, he couldn't maneuver the plane as it should be maneuvered. And landing, they finally cleared him for landing. And in landing, he came down and came down too low. And he hit the bank of the Chena River.
Mm.
See, which was around right there by the airport.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
He hit the bank and that killed him.
Mm-hmm. This is a separate incident from the other one that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. Well, we had a man there that he was working with the Russians and the Americans. What was his name? Well, anyway. After this accident, he came to me at the bar. He says, "Frank," he says, "I know you like this boy very much." He says, "Would you like to have his boots? You know, those leather boots that they wore, you know?" And I thought to myself, I was a little bit on the superstitious side. And I said, "No," I said, "thank you very much." I said, "I don't need those boots, you know." I said,
"You don't want to follow me, footsteps?"
He said, "You could have them for souvenir, you know."
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I didn't take them. But it was too bad. I liked that boy very much. He tried to learn more English by conversing with me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because when he got stuck, you know, I would try to explain to him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, there was a time they would ask me to leave the clubhouse, you know, and come back. And they had the whole crew in there, see. And they talked about weather conditions, stuff like that, you know,
mm-hmm.
and whatever. But they didn't want me to hear.
Oh.
Yeah, see, what they told somebody. They said, "This guy is learning too fast, you know." But anyway, I would leave. And then right next to the club, they assigned me a little room where I could lay down in there and take it easy or whatever, you know. And they would knock on the door when they got through with all their with all their business, you see. And then I would come out and I'd open up the bar again, see. And the boys would, whatever they wanted, I gave them, you know.
Mm-hmm. What building was this? Where was it in relationship to, say,
North? Well, it was not too far from... it was in the NCO. It was one of the NCO buildings,
mm-hmm.
see, and it was in the basement, see, and they gave rooms to the Russian officers
mm-hmm.
upstairs.
So it may still be there on base.
Yeah, they lived in those rooms, see, mm-hmm. with the NCO, American NCO, see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they needed that building for the Russians, so mm-hmm. After they left, they gave them to the NCOs,
mm-hmm.
non-commissioned officers, you know, sergeants or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They gave those rooms for them. See, they looked kind of a little of an apartment deal, see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll never forget the time